Hi everyone, welcome back to the 100th episode of Oi with the Terror. I'm one of your hosts, Danielle.
And I'm your other host, Sandra.
So it's finally the 100th episode, Yay. Unlike the last three episodes that I thought were the 100th.
Yeah, no, this is it. Finally, after have we been doing this for 3 years?
Maybe. Besides, yeah. Not counting the sabbatical.
Yeah, 2.5. Sure. 2.5. But that's pretty good.
Yeah. I didn't think we'd be doing it this long.
Nope.
It's fun, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, though. It is fun. It's also crazy to think of, like, just trying to find, like, more topics. I keep, like, being like, did I already do this one? Did Danielle talk about this one?
It actually happened to me with this topic in this episode. Mm-hmm. I thought for sure I'd covered it because I thought about doing it. I almost did it, like, 3 times. And for whatever reason, I just, like, pushed it off. And then I think it was around the sabbatical break we took for a few months. I think I was, like, almost going to do it then. And then I never did. So I'm like, why not just do it for the 100th episode?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Did you have a special one for today, or was it what you just, like, came upon?
It's kind of special, and you'll know why when I say what the topic is, probably. But, yeah, I picked one that's, like, kind of a little bit more closer to home, so to speak.
Ah. Is it about Boston?
Yes.
Okay. I'm excited. Mine is not. Mine takes place in Bavaria.
Wow. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, this is, I'm sure you know either about the person directly or you know what she influenced, which is a pretty famous horror movie that came out. I want to say a few years ago, but at this point it could have been almost like 10 or 15 years ago.
In Bulgaria?
Bavaria.
Oh, Bavaria, sorry.
But her thing took place in like the 70s, but the horror movie came out, I think, early 2000s, so.
Okay.
But it's like adapted, so they made a lot of changes to the movie, so it's not like a nonfiction or whatever. So I guess I'll get into it.
Yeah, now I'm curious because I'm trying to like rack my brain of like what horror movies came out at that time, and I don't think I'm picking the right ones. So,
well, I actually don't know if I've covered this topic already, but it involves an exorcism. So,
is exorcism in the title of the movie?
Yes.
I think I know which one it is.
You want to guess?
Is it The Exorcism of Emily Rose?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's what I was like leaning towards, but I wasn't sure.
I don't know if I've ever seen the movie, so I can't really speak to what they changed exactly. But I think they did change a lot, a good amount of it. So this is actually the tragic story of Annalise. I'm not sure if you pronounce her last name like Michelle or Michael. It's M-I-C-H-E-L, and they're from Bavaria. So
maybe Michael?
Michael? Yeah, I guess we'll just say Michael. Because I feel like Michelle is more of like a French way of saying, which is probably different. So yeah, I'll go with Michael. Okay, so this is a tragic story of Annalise Michael. So yeah, like I said before, I thought for sure I'd covered it, but I checked our archive folder and I did not see her name pop up in any of the titles of the other episodes, so hopefully I didn't cover it. As a warning, there are probably one of the reasons I was kind of putting off this subject is it does get pretty like brutal with like depictions of violence and cruelty, and as I mentioned, it involves exorcisms, so it's like a whole other level of like intense like religious tones. So if anyone is bothered by any of that, feel free to skip this story because it's pretty heavily inundated throughout. So as you guessed, Annalise Michael is the real life inspiration for the film The Exorcism of Emily Rose. And she was, the real person Annalise, was subjected to 67 Catholic exorcisms. And this is what ultimately led to her death at the age of 23 on July 1st, 1976. Oh, I guess actually a question I should ask you is like what you mainly remember from the movie.
I haven't seen it. I remember when it came out because a lot of like our mutual friends were really into horror, so they were really excited about it. I'm not a huge horror fan, so I don't think I saw it, but I do remember them trying to figure out if there was like a parallel between like the exorcism and then this particular movie, or if there was like a connection, because they weren't sure.
I remember, like, for whatever reason, I feel like the movie got a lot of attention when it came out, just because of the subject matter. Like, I feel like it was kind of the first big exorcism-related, like, newer horror movie, I think, maybe. I think that set off, like, other ones after that.
Yeah, because I think the only other, like, and I'll say this in parentheses, like, horror movie that I remember that was really big around that time was The Ring. I don't really remember, like, because that was, very different. So they kind of went, like, and there's obviously, like, I think, like, The Fast and the Furious, which I don't know if that's considered horror.
No.
No, not The Fast and the Furious. Sorry, the, fuck, what is it? Not The Fast and the Furious. It's another series that... Am I thinking of what is...
The Following?
Oh, my God. No.
Is The Following?
Oh, my God. What
the
is it?
The Haunting of Maggie Malloy.
No. It's like... They... Maybe it is the fact. I don't... There's a movie where there's like a bunch of kids and they go on a roller coaster... And one kid dies on the roller coaster.
They all die in weird ways.
Yeah, like one gets hit with
like the truck with like the logs on the highway.
Oh my God, what are those movies?
What is that movie called? Yeah, there's a bunch of them. When people die in weird ways.
Final Destination?
Yeah.
That's it.
Final Destination,
Thank you, Dave. Okay, so not Fast and the Furious, but Final Destination. My mistake. So, yeah, that was a really big thing also around that time, I think.
Okay, that makes more sense than Fast and Furious. I was going to, like, be like, I guess, but those are technically action, so.
Yeah, my bad. Final Destination. Okay. Maybe it with an F. Yeah, yeah, you're going to have to keep that in.
Yeah, that's funny. Okay, so yeah, so unless I'm not remembering, I actually don't know if I've actually talked about exorcisms before. I don't think you have, so this might be the first time it's being discussed on our podcast.
I don't remember, to be honest. Maybe they've been, like, mentioned, but I don't think we've done anything with them. Especially if you went through and you didn't see anything, I don't think we did.
Right. Yeah, like, I feel like there's always, I mean, like, the fact that it was a subject for horror movies or something kind of, like, I don't know if creepy is the right word, like, macabre about exorcisms. Like, there's the whole religious aspect, and then there's the whole, like, I don't know. I mean, being demonic possession thing is intense. And I just, like, my understanding of like exorcisms is like associated with Catholicism as well. Like it's like the classic priest like doing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I always kind of think of like if you've seen Outlander, like there's a episode where there's a little boy that's sick because he ate something, but they don't know why he's sick, so they think that he needs an exorcism. So they kind of like start to do it, but then obviously that gets stopped because they figure out like why he's sick. But
yeah, I'm like very cynical too. So like my thought is like, oh, they would blame the most random things on someone being possessed, like health issues, or a lot of the times like mental things going on. Like it kind of reminds me of like women specifically who were forced to go to like mental hospitals back in the day because like they were acting oddly and their husbands were scared, and it was just like they were just like not happy in their marriage or didn't know, like no one really saw therapists back in the day or whatever. So they'd like go to these like asylums or hospitals and like worst case like lobotomies or whatever, just because no one, like there weren't really mental health professionals trying to actually help people. It's just like worst case scenario, like someone's insane or possessed basically.
Yeah, I think a lot of mental illness was involved as well, and they would just do exorcisms for that instead of trying to help them.
Well, that's actually a segue into the Annalise Michael thing, because that is the main point of what was happening with her, which it seems like because of the time it happened in like the 60s, 70s, either a lack of resources or being very religious or whatever, her family like didn't know what to do when she started acting oddly. And they're like, must be a possession, but we'll later find out that it is not that. So, yeah, so I feel like this kind of serves as a sort of, like, cautionary tale and, like, specifically related to, like, religious obsessions and maybe people in power, like, using their, like, people of power using their power in the wrong way, I guess. So Annalise was raised in a devoutly Catholic household in Bavaria, West Germany in the 1960s. She was known as a like good student and had a good head on her shoulders type. She attended mass twice a week. She seemed to live a relatively normal, quiet, and sheltered life until one day at school she blacked out when she was 16 years old. And then apparently after that, she appeared to be in a trance-like state for the rest of that day. And this was reported by her family and friends who saw her acting strange. So apparently nothing happened for a year. When she experienced a similar sensation, she woke up in a trance-like state and then proceeded to wet her bed. And then her body started convulsing. Her family thought this meant she was possessed by a demon, and she was raised in a very religious household. That's basically the explanation for why her family thought this was like, this is what it had to be. But instead of seeking conventional forms of treatment, Annalise underwent 67 exorcisms, which led to great physical and emotional turmoil. So after her second trance-like episode, she did visit a neurologist, and she was diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy, a disorder which causes seizures, loss of memory, and both visual and auditory hallucinations. And this disease can also be related to experiencing a hyper-religious state of mind. In a way to move her life forward, Annalise did start taking medication to treat her epilepsy and started to attend the University of Würzburg in 1973. Apparently, she was also like an assistant teacher at the school. But the drugs failed to make a useful impact, and her condition continued to worsen as that year progressed. And Annalise became convinced she was possessed by a demon. And because the medication didn't seem to be working, she thought she had to look for alternative types of treatment. So she said she began to see the face of the devil wherever she went. And she said she heard demons whispering in her ears. And she heard demons telling her she was damned and would rot in hell while she was praying. So she concluded this meant that the devil must be possessing her. Annalise and her family thought the best course of action was to approach priests who would help with the demonic possession. But every priest they approached said that the young woman needed medical attention and not an exorcism. In the meantime, Annalise was deteriorating at a rapid pace physically and mentally, and she started performing extreme and unhealthy rituals. This included ripping her clothes off of her body, performing 400 squats a day, crawling under a table and barking like a dog for 2 days. She ate spiders, bit the head off of a dead bird, and licked her urine off the floor. But one day, Annalise and her mother found a priest, Ernst Alt, who said he believed that Annalise was possessed. And apparently, like, for his defense, as part of his defense, he later told the court, quote, she did not look like an epileptic, end quote. So Annalise wrote a letter to Ernst basically begging for his help. And she wrote that she felt despair and helplessness at her situation. But Ernst still needed to contact a bishop in order to perform an exorcism. Apparently he needed like a bishop to approve of the exorcism as part of the system. So local bishop Joseph Stengel did eventually approve the request and granted a local priest, Arnold Renz, the ability to perform the exorcism. So if anyone looks up Annalise Michael, there are a ton of like real photographs that were taken during the exorcisms, and it's just like it's a lot. It looks like she's basically being tortured. And you can just tell how fragile she looks and out of it, and it's really sad. And what gets me is in a lot of the photographs, you can see like a woman behind her, like helping her walk around, or in one photo, she's holding her head, and that's her mom. And that's just like the fact that her parents were there and fine with all this going on, like, blows my mind, honestly. Like, and they're, I'll get more into this later, but they do get involved in like legal court things because of all this, the priests and the parents. So yeah, so there are a bunch of photos if anyone wants to see. So in the 1960s, exorcisms were performed very rarely among Catholics in Bavaria, but apparently there was an increase in interest in exorcisms from both films and books that came out at that time, and a super popular movie that came out, The Exorcist, was like literally, it exploded, and that's a big reason why exorcism as a topic kind of renewed interest. Over the course of 10 months, Alt and Renz led 67 exorcisms on Annalise. Each one could last up to 4 hours. Annalise was convinced she was possessed by 6 demons, and this included Lucifer, Cain, Judas Iscariot, Hitler, Nero, and Fleischmann, a disgraced priest. I only know a few of those names, I don't know. So actual audio was captured during an exorcism, which captured Annalise communicating by using low growling noises. Throughout the sessions, Annalise would frequently talk about dying to atone for the wayward youth of the day and the apostate priests of the modern church. So definitely it seemed like this was all revolved around like a religious obsession thing that was going on. Like, I wouldn't be surprised she was hearing voices and hallucinations as part of her epilepsy, and for whatever reason, like, trying to make it logical, she if you really do believe in that stuff, I could see how she would, like, her brain would make that connection. So Annalise got so extreme with her, like, rituals that she actually broke bones in her body from the amount of times she was kneeling to pray. And also during the exorcisms, she had to be restrained. Her condition continued to worsen, and she eventually stopped eating and drinking and died of malnutrition and dehydration on July 1st, 1976. She was 23 years old. After she died, her story became a national sensation. The two priests involved and her parents were charged with negligent homicide. The priests were found guilty of negligent manslaughter and were sentenced to 6 months in jail and 1 year probation, but this later was suspended. Anna and Josef, Annalise's parents, did not receive any punishment as they were thought, under German law, to have suffered enough by the situation, and that was their form of punishment. So now the story of Annalise Michael is seen as a young woman who suffered unnecessarily with mental illness, which could have been treated had she been equipped with the proper resources. So yeah, so one of the main things that bothers me about this is just like the fact that her parents were in support of what was going on with the situation. Like, she was 23 years old, so like, not a child, but I get the feeling like she was very like lived in a bubble almost, like very family oriented and stuff like that. So I don't know, it just bothered me that like her parents at not at any point, like there were 67 exorcisms and they didn't try to step in at one point to try to stop the situation, or I don't know, that just bothers me.
Yeah, that's really hard to kind of hear, because I can understand it from a point where if they're convinced enough to go along with it, and the fact that the law was like, well, your daughter mm-hmm. is gone, you've suffered enough, you don't need to be punished anymore, is kind of jaw-dropping a little bit.
Yeah.
But also considering the time period, I can kind of understand maybe the medications weren't what they are now, mm-hmm. and there was mm-hmm. no way. They weren't educated enough to understand, and she was mm-hmm. very sheltered. So I can mm-hmm. understand, like, if, especially if, it, you know, if you are religious, especially Catholic, and a priest is telling you, you know, this is what you need to do, you're going to kind of probably believe them more.
I did find it interesting that they had to look for a while-ish to find this one person who's okay with it. And initially people, like priests, like you would think like they'd, an exorcism is in their wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. Like maybe they'd jump at it, but they had to like look, because each priest in the beginning said, no, she should see a medical professional. Like,
yeah.
It's like, oh, well, that's good at least.
But yeah, and that is good to hear, especially for like today. But yeah, also the fact that maybe they didn't have their full belief in medication, because she was on medication at one point and it wasn't working. So they turned more to the religious route, which is what some religions still kind of do today. But yeah, that is just...
Mm-hmm.
Disturbing. It's just sad, and it's disturbing all around for everybody, and also for the mom to just have to watch your daughter go through that. Not just the episode she was having, but the actual exorcisms. I don't know if I could do that.
I was reading that they had this, like, maybe more than one audio clip of her talking and growling during the exorcisms, and they were playing some of it in the court later, and her sister like freaked out and like ran out like crying when they were, yeah, like everyone was like in shock, like what the hell is this?
Yeah, because it's like you don't think that the human body is capable of doing that. But it's also like I've never seen the exorcism fully through. I've seen scenes. and just the way that they portrayed, like, what the actors had to go through to portray what they did for the 80s.
I know that movie.
It's crazy.
The Exorcist is known for, like, having a super weird and haunted, like, set when they were filming. I know that that's a thing. And I think when they filmed, like, the sequel, it was, like, something similar. Like, there was always weird stuff going on.
That's actually very common for a lot of movies that deal with, like, supernatural or, you know, that, like, exorcisms, that sort of thing. Because I believe it happened the same for the movie The Poltergeist. And there was one movie that came out not too long ago, and I forget her name. She's an older actress now. She was in it. And I think it had something to do with, like, the Warrens. Ed and Lorraine Warren, I think they were, like, involved.
Yeah, I know that they connected exorcisms.
So I know they were involved in this movie. I don't remember if it was based off of them. I'd have to, like, look it up. But she also had very strange things that happened to her during the filming. And then once they were done, she was, like, she got diagnosed with, like, a weird blood disorder or something. And then she was fine once they were done filming. So it's just weird stuff like that, because you don't really know, like, what you're really, like, messing with. But I'd be curious to now kind of see the trailer, at least for this movie, to see, like, what they took and how they portrayed it. Because I can see them doing a few different things to change it.
I'm a fan of, like, these types of movies, because I feel like they just make it, like, the most, like, it's basically unbelievable. Like, how the contortions and stuff like that. Like, I believe, like, the photos of her look, like, really bad, Annalise, but, like, I don't think she was able to bend her body like a pretzel. Like, it's, I feel like, I don't know, unless there's, like, an exorcism movie that exists that's more realistic. Like,
yeah,
the ones I've seen are just, like, there's no way this happened.
Yeah, I don't. And that's the thing, too, is, like, when you're dealing with a movie like that, how much are you able to stick to the story to make people still interested in it without it becoming too Hollywood?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'd be interested to see. I mean, I also don't love horror films. They're not my favorite.
Right.
But, I don't know. I guess I would be interested to at least, like, watch the trailer, I guess.
I mean, it could be a good topic. If you ever need another topic, if you do, like, hauntings from famous movie sets.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing that at one point, but I couldn't find too much on it at the time. But maybe now there'll be more.
I feel like there has to be a thing, like TV shows, movies.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Let me just, while I'm thinking of it, let me look up. Because this is going to bug me because I can't think of this movie. Okay, so the actress I was talking about, her name is Joey King. She's been around for a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it happened when she was filming for The Conjuring.
Oh.
She had unexplained bruises, and then she was diagnosed with a blood-thinning condition called ITP. Which is very strange.
That's not a bad horror movie, actually, The Conjuring.
That's why I was like, I think it has to do with Ed and Lorraine Warren. It does kind of. So, yeah, that's, I don't know. I feel like that one was pretty good from what I've heard. Like, it wasn't, you know, the worst horror movie.
Yeah, I would, I haven't seen any new ones in a few years, but the last newer one, like, that I thought was good was probably The Conjuring. There's another one that's good. It's kind of like horror comedy called Cabin in the Woods
that I've seen that a
few times.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
I saw that against my will.
Satire, kind of.
Yeah.
Not really?
I saw it in grad school because every Friday night, my roommates and I would do like a movie night, or Sunday night, we'd do like a movie night. So we'd all pick five movies and have everybody vote for which one we wanted to watch. And there was always like a theme. And that one was the horror theme, and they knew I didn't like horror, so they were like, we'll be nice, and we'll just watch this one. So I watched it. I thought it was very interesting. The twist at the end was interesting. But yeah, no, it was actually pretty good. It wasn't, it was definitely satire, but I enjoyed it.
Right. There are a lot of different kinds of horror genres. like that you could have.
Especially now, I feel like, with like Netflix is getting involved in horror stuff and all of these different streaming services are like doing their own horror stuff. And on that note, I'll jump into my topic. But that was a good topic, Daniel. Good job. Okay, so the topic that I picked this week is the Granary Burying Ground in Boston.
Ooh. It's
that infamous cemetery that's next to Suffolk that you know pretty well.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah. So that's actually, weirdly enough, one of my favorite like cemeteries to visit in Boston. It is open during the day and it is free. So if you ever come to Boston, it's definitely in a very good place. It's located in on Tremont Street, and it's near the Park Street Church. It's near Park Street. It's near Faneuil Hall. It's near the Omni Hotel, which I talked about in another episode a long time ago. So it's in a very good area of Boston, and it was founded back in 1660, and primarily it is the burial ground most known for the Revolutionary War era patriots. Some of these do include Paul Revere. It also has the five victims from the Boston Massacre and three signers of the Declaration of Independence, including Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and Robert Treat Paine. It is a cemetery that has 2,345 grave markers, but historians estimate that there may be as many as 5,000 people that are actually buried in the cemetery. And like I said, it is adjacent to Park Street Church, Suffolk University Law School. It is on the Freedom Trail, and it was designed by the architect Isaiah Rogers, who lived from 1800 to 1869, and they also designed an identical gate for Newport's Touro Cemetery. So a little history about the actual cemetery. Like I said, it was established in 1660 after predating King's Chapel Burying Ground reached its full capacity. And it's known as the South Burying Ground, and then it was renamed as Granary after the adjacent grain storing building that stood where the Park Street Church actually stands today. It did accept new burials for over 200 years, and its last burial was said to have taken place in 1880. It was once a field of graves grazed by cattle, and then it was revamped into a more aesthetically appealing park-like cemetery in 1830. That's when the city decided to plant trees and shrubbery to kind of adjoin every corner of the park, and the headstones were then more neatly aligned to help clean the cemetery's appearance and to allow for the grounds to be landscaped by the lawnmower, which was, I guess, a very big innovation at the time. And during that same period, it was enclosed in an Egyptian revival gate, like I said earlier, that was designed by Isaiah Rogers. And right now, there is estimated to be 5,000 remains that are buried in the cemetery. Yet today, less than half of those gravestones actually remain. There was a hidden crypt that was discovered back in 2009. Apparently on February 12th, 2009, in an issue of the Boston Globe, a woman that was touring the graveyard fell through into the ground, and she fell into what appeared to be some sort of stairway that led to an underground tomb. This tomb was the large brick crypt, which was about 8 by 12 feet to be exact, and it was believed to have been built to store the remains of the Boston mayor, Jonathan Armitage, who died back in 1751. This was a pretty significant discovery, so there may be some other hidden areas of the granary today that we just still haven't uncovered. They do also, For some reason, Boston has very peculiar tombstones that do distinguish themselves from others in America due to the city's strict Puritan foundations. So Puritans essentially scoffed at the association between humanity and sacred beings such as God or angels. Therefore, they prohibited the depiction of these spiritual entities on the headstones themselves. So with that restriction in place, the stone carvers had to get creative. And that's where they did adorning gravestones with death-inspired imagery. So some of these include the Grim Reaper, the Father Time, were some of the ones from the 17th century imagery that were carved onto the gravestones. And so if you do kind of scroll, or if you do stroll through the graveyard, you'll see kind of two particular carvings. One is Death's Head, which is a skull that's paired with wings or crossbones. And then there's the Soul Effigy, which is a winged cherub. And both of these motifs were very popular during the 17th and 18th century. And they were meant to represent the soul's ascension into heaven. To accompany the death imagery, the artist also included dead tone epitaphs to provoke acknowledgement of the fleeting nature of life and contemplating the many gravestones still standing in Granary today is going to give you a visual insight into Boston's past, while also allowing you to kind of tap into the ancestral views of immortality. So like I said earlier, there's a lot of really well-known people that are buried there, including Paul Revere, which if you do go and you'll see that there's a very, very big gravestone next to a very, very small one. The bigger one is more of like a monument. The small one is his actual gravestone, which I learned just from going there. Other people include the parents of Benjamin Franklin, along with other members of the Franklin family. Franklin himself is actually buried at Christ Church Burial Ground in Philadelphia. There's also Mary Goose, who it's kind of unlikely, but apparently has a claim of the locals to being the original Mother Goose. So referring to those like Mother Goose stories that were very, very popular. Other people buried there include Peter Faneuil, who was the benefactor of Faneuil Hall, as well as John Hancock, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and who was the first governor of Massachusetts, James Otis Jr., who was a lawyer and a Revolutionary War patriot, Samuel Sewall, who was one of the judges for the Salem witch trials. So if you go there, there's just a ton of very well-known people that are buried there, which is kind of interesting because the graveyard itself doesn't really feel very big. So there is one particular ghostly resident that does roam the Granary Burying Ground, and that is a specter by the name of James Otis Jr. So he was a very prominent Boston lawyer, and I guess he got a bottle broken over his head during a bar fight, and this caused his brain functions to become extremely impaired. So in turn, that affected his mental health. Legend has it, he wrote a letter to God amid his crippling depression, begging to be struck down by lightning and killed. And as if by fate, he was struck by lightning while at home, and he did die instantly. His remains were interred in Granary Burying Ground, where he appears to visitors both during the day and at night, dressed in a colonial era thread. So you can kind of see him walking around. And he is kind of one of the only or most well-known spirit of that area. There are also people that have said to experience just really strange and having very weird encounters. One of the many mystery events that seem to occur often is when visitors will take photos. And after leaving, they view their photos only to discover that there are floating orbs or there are shadowy faces that were not actually visible to them when they are on the property. So if you are interested in going to the Granary Burying Ground, like I said, it is available and it is free during the day. You can also visit it on the Freedom Trail. That's also featured in a few of the ghost tours in Boston as well. For instance, I know Danielle and I did the Ghost and Gravestones Boston Ghost Tour a couple of years ago, and we did go there. It's also in the Ghost City tours. I believe it's featured there as well. So if you are interested, definitely recommend it. It's a really beautiful cemetery for during the day. At night, it's very creepy, but It's a lot of fun if you do go on one of those tours, because you also learn a lot about the city as well. So,
yeah, I feel like when you, if you don't go to Boston often, it's one of the places you should check out. It's like a classic.
Yeah, it's that. It's in a really great location. It's very easy to get to.
That's true.
There's a lot to do down there. And it's just like, they do keep it up very nice. I will say they do a very good job with the upkeep. So it is just kind of like, if it's a nice like spring or summer day, like if when I find myself down there, like I'll just go and walk through, and you kind of get to listen in on like the Freedom Tours, if they're doing a Freedom Tour for the Freedom Trail. And
it definitely is in a really good location. Yeah. It's so what's the cemetery in the other famous old one that's like in the north end?
I think that's the only one other one I can think of for Boston. It's the King's, and that's like,
okay,
it's pretty close.
That one more.
Yeah, they're very close to each other. Because there's Granary, and then if you go a little bit further down the street and look across the street, there's another cemetery, and I think that's the, is it King's, I never remember the name of it, the King's Chapel Burying Ground. So that's a little bit further down the street. So they're relatively close together.
Got it.
And sometimes what they'll do is on these ghost tours, they'll take you to the Granary and they'll take you to the King's Chapel, or they'll take you like around it. But those are the only two that I think I've really been to. I don't know if I've, at least in Boston, those are the only two like really big ones.
Yeah, so. Those are the main ones I can think of too from the ghost tour we did and everything.
Yep. I mean, there probably is another one in the North End. I just don't go down to the North End enough to like.
And that one has the fun fact about the molasses massacre. Yeah, what's it called? What disaster?
Massacre. You did a story on it. That was one of your topics.
Disaster, I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, that, if you go there and it's a really hot day, you can still smell the molasses. So they say. But that's like also if you go down to Newbury Street and it's a really hot day, you can still smell the swamp, because that was all swampland before they came in. So you can kind of do that. Like I've had that happen where I've walked around Newbury Street in like a hot summer day.
Is that where Isabella Stewart Gardner lived in a brownstone on a, I think it was like Back Bay.
It's like the same area, probably the same thing, where if it's really hot, you can kind of smell the swamp because it was swampland. Like, we built on swampland.
Yes.
And we're wondering why we're having flooding issues, but. All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us on our 100th episode of Oi with the Terror. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We are available to listen to anywhere where podcasts are available to listen to. We drop a new episode every Thursday. If you do have any spooky stories, please let us know. You can send us an email to oiwiththeterroralready@gmail.com. And we will see you all next time.
Bye.